Hi, I'm Anne Strainchamps, and today, on To the Best of Our Knowledge, I want to talk to you about being white. That sounds strange, doesn't it, to talk about whiteness? Because most of the time, when we talk about race in America, and we talk about it a lot, we talk about the experience of people of color. But maybe that's a problem. Maybe we're missing something.
I grew up in this almost exclusively white suburb, and it never occurred to me how strange it was that I was living in an all-white space.
Debbie Irving grew up like a lot of white people, almost unaware that she was white.
I didn't understand what racial privilege was at all.
And that's racial privilege in a nutshell. It's when whiteness gets coded as normal or the default.
Exactly. Race was something that belonged to black and brown people. And that can sound so naive, so I would make a distinction between I absolutely knew I was white and I could check that off on a census form, but if you had said to me, Debbie, describe how being white has shaped your worldview, I would have had nothing to say. I couldn't have answered that. I would have thought that was a stupid question.
So today, Debbie Irving is a racial justice educator. She travels the country teaching people how to have uncomfortably honest conversations about race and privilege. And she talks about her own experience of, in her words, waking up white, which, she says, happened embarrassingly late in life.
It was a graduate school course. I was 48 years old. It was only 7 years ago. And I had gone back to get my master's in special education. I was a classroom teacher. And yes, there was a moment. It was the straw that broke the camel's back. And it was the night that I learned about the GI Bill, which was something that I knew my father, who was a World War II veteran, had used, and my uncles had used them to get higher education degrees and to buy their first homes. And I learned that the GI Bill was not accessible to most of the 1 million black GIs. The feeling I had in my body when I learned that was a little bit like the night I learned my father dropped dead. It's that feeling of, this can't be true. Tell me this isn't true. Please, I don't want this to be true. It was a shock to my system, and it began a process of grieving where I really had to come to terms with the America I was taught about wasn't really a complete story, that there were a lot of stories I hadn't heard, and it meant that there was discrimination going on in ways I didn't understand.
So I have to ask you, this is one of those uncomfortable moments, because I can imagine that plenty of people of color you've encountered must think, really? You just woke up and realized something that we live with every single day?
Yeah. It's the big elephant in the room is that, you know, white people, many, many white people across America think the playing field is level. And so I can see now that people in my life had been trying to get through to me, but I would very silently judge what they were saying, and in my head think, oh man, you got to stop complaining and just go with the program.
Well, I mean, there have been moments for you of greater discomfort. I mean, there's a story you tell in the book, right, about a conference. Oh, there was, what was it? There was a film at a conference for professionals of color. Yeah. Tell that story.
So that was a conference, and it was exclusively for people of color. There were a very small number of white people there. And a group of filmmakers of color in the schools had gotten together, and they're trying. Again, this is the old story. How can we get white people to understand this? And so they had put together this film. They screened it. And I, of course, was one of the first people to stand up and raise my hand. I had no idea how inappropriate that was, really, in that setting. And I said, I watched the film, but I feel like I need more detail from those stories to get it. Because in the film, people were telling ways in which they had felt marginalized in their school communities. And my comment, and just the look of me, I'm sure, and the sound of me, it just triggered a whole bunch of people, and they really let me have it. And, you know, I was afraid, I was angry, I was defensive. Fortunately, I had a woman beside me who said, just sit down and just listen. There's a lot of history in this room. And so I did. I took her advice. Otherwise, I think I would have started saying, but I didn't mean it that way. So, you know, that was a day where I really learned, A, how much pain there is, B, that there's a certain amount of entitlement to think I can just stand up in any space and raise my hand and get heard.
Did you take away from that the feeling that you should be a lot more careful in any kind of discussion about race?
Huh. It's funny. I think I took away some of that. What I really took away was that I had to be a lot more resilient. I needed to become much more able to hear feedback and not take it personally. And if I was going to be in this conversation, I just needed to be okay making mistakes. It wasn't that I needed to be perfect. I needed to be okay making mistakes and to really, really learn from each and every one. Because to put a room full, there were probably 150 people of color trying to do their work that day, and I derailed that discussion. That's a huge cost. To not put that cost to good use and do my own learning, I wouldn't want to do that. And so the way I put it to use is not to try to be more perfect, but to try to be more resilient and understand what being engaged and being vulnerable and being resilient looks like.
Because I asked because I think that one of the points that you make over and over again is that, at least in certain circles of white people, there's this whole culture of niceness. And, the one thing you don't want to do is trigger that kind of rage. And so people just pull back from even having the conversation. Whereas it sounded to me like what you were saying is, no, I don't think we should pull back at all. I think we just learned to get a lot better at taking it.
Exactly. And staying with it. Yeah. I mean, we get a lot of messages not to create conflict. And the problem is, if you spend your life avoiding conflict, you don't develop any skills to navigate it. I mean, it's never comfortable to be in conflict, but I don't freak out about the fact that my stomach is in knots. And I actually have built some skills. Mm. And my family, we've all built skills around it because we now, we don't avoid the elephant in the room anymore.
So there's another story I wanted to ask you about, another moment in your, as you were unpacking your own white privilege, checking your own white privilege. It's a story about a time when you were trying to do something good. You were part of an arts project that was taking inner city kids to see some kind of theater performance, I think.
Oh, yeah. This was my first big move out of college as a in the nonprofit world. I raised money to bring inner city youth to daytime performances in Boston theaters. And so I would organize, 9 or 10 buses, and they would be full of these kids coming from these neighborhoods that I hadn't even stepped foot in yet. And I call it my Robin Hood syndrome because I felt so good that I was using my social connections to raise money to bring kids to the theater. And I was sure that it would be a positive experience for them. Mm-hmm. Because I was only operating from my own perspective. That was a pause. I would have liked that when I was a kid. What I didn't recognize was that I was putting kids on buses, and these were predominantly Black, African-American kids, maybe between the ages of 8 and 12, middle school kids, bringing them to a white, a kind of uptown white space and going into a theater. It wasn't all great for them. It was scary. It was scary to get on a bus. It was scary to go in an all-white space. So that just speaks to the white people are so prone to want to help and fix and think. I thought I knew how to help and fix, and I was so off base. And not to say some of those kids might not have had a good time, but think of the other things that might have been done with that money.
I'm curious, how do you respond to white people who say, and I'm sure you've heard this a lot, I don't feel like I'm better than anybody else because I'm white, and I don't see why I should apologize or feel guilty for being white?
I don't ask people to feel guilty. I mean, if someone said that to me, I won't, why are you leading with guilt? Where's your sense of rage at the injustice? I mean, I think with any kind of privilege, some guilt will be in there too. But there are a lot of feelings. The most important thing to do is to start feeling. Just feel. Because we spend so much time in our heads that the idea of just thinking, if once you start to learn more versions of American history than just the one, if you're white, you've been taught in school and through your family stories and on TV and movies, when you start to learn it, it's going to cause some strong feelings. And if guilt is where you go, let yourself feel it and let it go. But eventually, I hope you get to anger. And I hope you get to motivation to make the system change. Because, you know, guilt and shame are two emotions that will just stop us in our tracks and keep us from making change.
This phrase, check your privilege, is increasingly common in so many settings. And this is the thing that you just raised is really my big question. Who benefits from privilege checking?
The thing about white privilege, and any privilege, class privilege, able-bodied privilege, gender privilege, sexual orientation privilege, health privilege, we can't get rid of it, but you can leverage it. So I have leveraged both my class privilege, which gives me money, and my racial privilege as a white person. Now, I've packaged that in a book that speaks to what the experience of upper-class white privilege can look like. So I'm leveraging it to try to create awareness. But I can't give my privilege away. I walk through the street every day, and I don't get harassed by a policeman. I go in to take out a loan from a bank, and I don't go through the three-month set of hoops that your average person of color will have to go through. There's a host of benefits I get that I don't even know. And being aware of that is important because then I can use that awareness to try to create change in the system.
Well, I guess the question is, you know, how do you do something like what you've done, write this book, and not just make it about yourself?
My brother said to me recently, "Wow, Debbie, you must be so satisfied." And, you know, I thought for a minute, I thought, no, I'm not satisfied. The goal of writing this book wasn't to sell books. The goal of writing this book was to create awareness so that change could happen. I got advice early on from Peggy McIntosh, who wrote a seminal article called Unpacking the Invisible Knapsack. And she said, you can only tell your own story, Debbie. It will resonate with people or it won't, but that's the best thing you can do. It's the best thing all of us can do is tell our own stories. And us, I don't just mean white people, I mean people of all colors. Telling our stories gives us so much insight into the system that we all share.
That's Debbie Irving. She's the author of Waking Up White and Finding Myself in the Story of Race. So Debbie's reaction to discovering her own white privilege was to do something about it. She wound up building a whole new career as a racial justice educator and activist. But talking about white privilege doesn't always have such positive outcomes. Philosopher Naomi Zack believes that if we really want to fight racism, a good first step would be to stop talking about privilege. Steve Paulson asked her to explain.
Naomi, you've said that we need to rethink the way we talk about privilege. What's wrong with the idea of this phrase, checking your privilege?
A privilege is something extra. It's a special convenience or a perk that you get, which is not vital. And I think what is at issue is rights. It's not a question of whites having privileges that non-whites don't have. It's a question of the rights of non-whites not being taken as seriously as the rights of whites.
Can you give me an example of a privilege versus a right?
There have been a number of cases of unarmed young black men who've been shot by police who were not otherwise involved in any criminal activity or confrontation. This has given rise to a national conversation here and there about white privilege, and it's considered to be a privilege if people don't have to worry that the police might accidentally or deliberately in the heat of a moment shoot their children. Well, that's not a privilege. You know, that shifts what's really going on to the ease that white people have in the culture. What those incidents are rights violations. They're not a question of whether or not a different group has certain privileges. So to dwell on privileges while the rights of other people are being violated is something like, in the case of wealth, we address poverty by asking rich people to tell us how nice their lives are.
It sounds like you're saying that by reframing this issue as a matter of rights, it becomes a moral issue and probably also a legal issue. I mean, in terms of actually how we define this whole thing.
Well, you know, it's a legal issue in a very interesting way because we already have formal equality. I think this is a question of more work in legal infrastructure rather than requiring any change in laws that already exist, because you have to realize that for most white people, the system functions fairly well.
Can you play this out for me then? So what specific actions might be taken, let's say by police departments, if this particular issue is seen as a matter of a violation of rights?
Police could have a number of changes. There could be better rules of engagement. There could be a relaxation of the policy of racial profiling.
I want to back up for a moment and sort of and unpack this whole notion of privilege, of white privilege in particular, because there has been so much focus on that recently. And you're not actually saying that white privilege isn't real, are you?
No, I'm not. No, white privilege is real. What I'm criticizing is the discourse of white privilege is undertaken by white people as a response to some of the tragedies that the country has witnessed over the past couple of years.
Okay, so what don't you like about the way white privilege is talked about these days by academics and other people?
Well, I think it's irrelevant. I think it's somewhat decadent. It doesn't address the problem. It becomes an avenue for self-flattery and reflection. I mean, one of the things it might motivate people to do is it might motivate greater politeness. That's a good thing. But it doesn't address the hard issues. In other words, it allows white people to talk about themselves, and things are okay for them. So that's not really a problem. I don't think it's a way of addressing an ongoing problem.
So basically you're saying that the white people who do talk about being privileged, you know, they might feel a little guilty about it, but they're not going to change anything for the most part.
No, they're not going to change anything. And it's not clear that guilt serves any purpose here. I mean, I think there's a question of passivity.
Let's pick up again this question of racial profiling by the police. Why do you think so many police departments actually do engage in this kind of racial profiling and all of these cases of young black men in particular getting stopped?
Well, I think that they're using the criminal justice system statistics instead of the statistics for the overall population. The other reason is there's been a policy in policing called the broken window policy. And the idea behind broken windows is that if you stop small crimes and misdemeanors, you'll prevent larger crimes from occurring. So pick up people who are drinking in public or loitering or jumping subway turnstiles, and that will discourage more severe violent crime. There's some dispute in the literature about how accurate that is.
Now, there has, of course, been enormous public attention to this whole question of police violence over the last two or three years or so. But I'm wondering if you think we need a different kind of national conversation about these issues. I mean, is there a better way to talk about this?
Yeah, we need more specific proposals, you know, and we should hear from the police.
Do you see any of this happening? I mean, what you've been talking about, you know, sort of the emphasis more on rights or more specifically hearing more directly from the police themselves. I mean, are we starting to see any kind of a shift?
Well, yeah, I think there is a shift. Oregon, the state in which I live, recently passed a law against the use of racial profiling. Now, the numbers of non-white minorities in the state of Oregon are relatively low, but nevertheless, that's a big change. I don't know the details of that law yet or how it will play out or what kinds of difference it will make, but this is a national process, and we're probably not even yet in the middle of it. We're probably still in the beginning of it.
Well, this is a sort of a fascinating perspective. Thank you so much for coming in to talk about this.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Naomi Zack teaches philosophy at the University of Oregon. Her latest book is called White Privileges and Black Rights. Coming up on college campuses, checking your privilege is an increasingly common part of the undergraduate experience. How's that working out? I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio. and PRX. We're talking about checking your privilege this hour, and that phrase is getting invoked more and more often on college campuses these days. It's part of what some people call a new wave of political correctness. Greg Lukianoff recently wrote a cover story for The Atlantic in which he argued that this new PC culture is leaving college students ill-equipped to deal with the real world and may even be damaging their mental health.
I think sometimes we try to control discussions too much, and I think that's exactly what's happening on campuses. We think that if people from different classes and different backgrounds actually talk to each other, that some kind of disaster would happen. So I think it partially comes from the fact that, you end up having pretty politically homogeneous environments on campus. And even to the degree that they're not, we've created a situation in which, partially through speech policing, we're encouraging people just to talk to the people they already agree with. So I think you see sort of an absurd and exaggerated sort of microcosm of what's happening in our larger society on our campuses, where we've become stuck sort of in our echo chambers and increasingly angry over smaller things, which is problematic in its own right. But what really troubles me is I think it also takes us away from thinking about things that, you know, can actually be fixed or can actually help people who are genuinely suffering from, you know, what might be called macroaggressions. You know, I work on college campuses, and I've been defending free speech on college campuses for 15 years. And, you know, most of that time has been butting heads with administrators. But in the last 2 years, I've been disturbed to see that a lot more of it seems to be coming from students. I'll talk about what case is going on right now at Wesleyan. The student government is considering defunding the student newspaper because they ran an article that was critical of the tactics of the Black Lives Matter movement. Now, this wasn't an inflammatory article, and it would have been perfectly well answered with another op-ed. But instead, this led immediately to not just protests, but a very proud declaration that students were going to start, quote-unquote, recycling copies of the student newspaper until their demands were met or until the Argus, the name of the newspaper, was defunded. I've seen different versions of this my entire career, but the thing that made it somewhat different was just the pride with which the students were talking about what amounted to newspaper destruction. One of the reasons why we're seeing such high rates of depression and anxiety is partially just we're reaping what we've sown. We're telling a generation, frankly, you're not competent, you're very fragile. If something bad happens, you'll be damaged forever, you won't bounce back, you'll be broken. And then we're shocked that we have anxious and depressed students. It just simply is always valuable to know what people really think, and especially if it's really bad. And I think that we create this sort of false sense of security to a degree by simply policing speech will somehow be fixing our society when we might not be getting at the roots of the beliefs that we disagree with. But even just beyond that, you're not really going to understand your world all that well unless you know what people really think. And I think with a problem of self-censorship and people organizing just in the groups that they already believe in, we've lost the idea that candor across lines of genuine difference is good, especially when it's messy.
Greg Lukianoff heads the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, and he's the author of Unlearning Liberty: Campus Censorship and the End of American Debate. You can hear a longer version of his interview on our website at ttbook.org. And now it's time for A Dangerous Idea.
My name is Nina Jablonski. I'm a professor of anthropology at Penn State. I study human evolution and human diversity. My dangerous idea is that we should teach all children about the origin of humans and why we look differently. And I'll tell you why. We live in a country and in a world in which there is considerable misunderstanding about race and the nature of human races. Tension sometimes exists between people who identify as belonging to different races, especially when they think that those people who look different from them are going to act different too, or that they might pose a threat. There's a lot of talk today about the dangers of implicit bias, which springs from the stereotypes we harbor about one another and that affect our understanding actions and decisions in an unconscious and often powerful manner. Implicit biases are reversible, and they're also avoidable. So my dangerous idea is about tackling the implicit bias arising from racial stereotypes, where it starts, in the home and in early childhood education. Racism is caused by many things, but implicit bias allows racism to manifest itself. Implicit bias about races is often based on an assumption that races have a biological reality, and further, that people not only look differently but act differently because of differences in their inherent biological makeup. This is wrong, but most people don't know it's wrong. And formal education about human diversity is often limited to anthropology courses in universities or maybe in some high schools. So wouldn't it be great if every child in the United States learned some basic facts about human biological diversity when they were little, let's say when they are 7 or 8? Kids love learning about themselves, so let's teach them in basic and understandable terms about human evolution and why people look the way they do. It would be marvelous if kids could learn about the recent shared ancestry of all people and the origins of some of the interesting and visible differences between people, like skin color. When these phenomena become a source of wonder and delight and are understandable, it's much less likely that kids will make value judgments about physical attributes. We may not be able to prevent entirely the formation of implicit biases, but we can go a long way toward this goal by educating our children in this way.
Anthropologist Nina Jablonski with her dangerous idea, and you can hear more of those dangerous ideas on our website at ttbook.org. So we've been examining privilege in this hour, and what it really comes down to, what we're really talking about, is how to have meaningful conversations about difference and race. Conversations that all too often are uncomfortable and stressful and something we avoid. Safiya Samatar is a Somali-American poet, educator, and writer, and a few weeks ago, she wrote an essay about what it's like to be an academic of color in a largely white university. She talks about feeling exposed and self-conscious and just generally really uneasy with the idea of being reduced to a symbol of diversity. She sat down with Charles Monroe Kane, who's an old friend of hers, and they talked about why organizations need to focus less on measuring diversity and more on how we talk about race.
Within institutions, how do we measure? Well, we measure by appearance, by the appearance of skin. So the more Black professors you have, the higher your numbers are, and so on, the more Black students you have, et cetera, or other, you know, groups of color. But that's considered enough. And so it's all in this sort of visual mode. It's all about how much you can see and how much you can represent on a graph.
I know you. I mean, full disclosure again here. I mean, you and I are friends. We've known each other for years and years and years. Our kids play together, all these things. As we're talking about fitting into a quota, what are you?
I am Black. I am African-American. I am Somali-American. I mean, I think what I try to get into in the essay is the fact that it's not just are you Black and stop, right? Because globally, you know, Blackness is very complex, right? And locally, Blackness is very complex.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm Black. But then, you know, so what? Like, where do we go after that? Like, what comes after that? Well, in an institutional context, in my experience, not a whole lot.
What do you want? I mean, you're in academia probably for the rest of your life. What would you like to see on that diversity front? How can we measure it so we know that people are being fair? Because that's real.
Yes, absolutely. And I think what I'd like to do, actually, is answer that question by reading a couple of lines from my essay.
Sure.
In which I'm sort of responding to that question, because I'm imagining that people are reading the essay and they're going, well, what do we do then? You know, you don't like the diversity committees and you don't like the PowerPoint slides and you don't like the way that we're doing it. What's your solution? You know, so what I said was, try to read the demand for solutions and your frustration for what they are. Products of the logic of diversity work, which wants to get the debt paid, over with, done. Diversity work is slow, and yet it's always in a rush. It can't relax. It can't afford the informal gesture, the improvised note, the tangential question that moves off script, away from representation, into some weird territory of you and me talking in this room right now. So what I'm trying to say there is that the solutions that I believe in are unpredictable. Because I'm really working in the essay, I'm sort of taking jazz as a model.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, about jazz improvisation. Do you mind sharing how you use jazz in the story?
Yeah, well, I use it in a couple different ways. I mean, the essay starts with this kind of interesting historical connection, which is that I work at California State University, Channel Islands, and the site, it used to be Camarillo State Mental Hospital. And Charlie Parker spent about 6 months there between 1946 and 1947 recovering after a serious heroin withdrawal. So that was really exciting for me to discover when I started working at the school. And then I wanted to, you know, research his life, and I tried to find his room, you know. So then I started looking into the story of how he wound up there, and also kind of the story of his music and how incredibly off-puttingly difficult his music was. And I found something powerful in that, in this idea of an expression that prevents complete access, where you can't just get by with the surface.
Right.
You're not going to get it if you're just at the level of the surface. So that was kind of the way that the essay took off.
And what happens with his clothing? Because I did not know this story. What happened there?
Well, he was suffering from pretty severe withdrawal, and he was trying to fix it with alcohol and other things. And then one night he took all his clothes off and walked into the hotel lobby. And then he was arrested after that and taken to the county jail.
You know, it's interesting. I have a bit of a party background, so I read that and I'm like, yeah, man, hardcore, you know, drinking alcohol to get off heroin and jazz and stuff. But not this time. When I read it in context of your story, I was like, oh my God, he's completely exposed. And mm-hmm. you use that word a lot in your essay, and I've never heard that word used in the context of race. What does that mean to you?
Yeah, well, I use it over and over again because I'm riffing on it, right? So it's constantly that word expose and exposure is constantly coming back in the essay, but in a different mode. So at one point, it's Charlie Parker taking his clothes off. At one point, it's Black hypervisibility. That is the fact that if you're Black within a predominantly white institution, then you feel exposed, especially if the topic of race comes up. You know, either people look at you or you could, everybody's trying really hard not to look at you. And, you know, it's even worse for students. So there's that kind of exposure. And then there is the fact that, you know, hypervisibility and invisibility are related, because the more that you are extremely visible as Black, the less you are visible as an individual, as a person.
It's interesting. I was thinking about, you know, that you're Mennonite, that you are also Somali, and you're viewed by most Americans as being Black, by as being African-American, just because of your skin color. Do you care about these categories for yourself? Are you aware of them?
Yeah, of course I'm aware of them. I have to be aware of them. I'm reminded of them all the time, you know, because people ask me, oh, what kind of name is that? Or what's your background? Where are you from? Almost every day. So yeah, I'm very aware.
So what do you think, white people find you more safe?
Than what?
Well, I think Americans, white Americans, and I would put myself in this category, are just scared to death of race, man. We're like, oh my God, you know, if I say something wrong, I'm going to be put out as a racist, or as a male, if I say something wrong, I'm going to be a misogynist. And we're afraid. And so because we have a lot of power, we're able to choose sometimes not to engage. But when we do engage, we're definitely scared. We're so afraid to have those labels put on us. And we meet someone who isn't traditionally what we consider African-American, but still Black, then I think we feel safer to have the conversation to be different. And I think that the more, quote unquote, Black you are in America, the more I think white America is afraid of you.
I agree with you that somebody like me, somebody with lighter skin, somebody who talks white, is going to be safer, for sure. But do I experience white people confiding in me about race? No, I don't.
You know, I want to go back to exposure because it's such a powerful thing in your essay. It made me realize I'd ask myself a question. Do I feel exposed? And I was thinking about this, and I'm wondering if, like, if checking my privilege is something that is a positive thing, or it just make me feel better. And I'm wondering if you find that in yourself as well, that somehow there's a lot of privilege checking going on, and even though I can tell a nice little story to make myself look cool, in the end, it's not really going to change anything.
Well, I think, again, this gets back to this idea of change and this idea of solutions. And I'm really, you know, the essay that I wrote is a search, right? It's an exploration. So I'm just trying things out. I'm testing and I'm trying to figure out new models. And I'm looking at improvisation and saying, okay, well, you know, I've experienced this very rigid institutional kind of approach to solutions, and I don't think it works. So let's try something that's the opposite of that, like jazz. So then where do we go from that? Well, for me, I'm looking for those improvisation models, which means that I can't predict.
Right. I mean, that's the thing, right? Miles Davis said what? He said the best thing about jazz is it makes him afraid because he have no idea where we're going to go next. So it's kind of scary for me. Again, I'm the white dude, right? And I'm like, oh my God, how is this going to work out? Like, where is this going to go? And it really makes me afraid. Do you feel that trepidation because you're like, man, this is scary. We have no idea where this will go.
I find the idea exciting. I don't find it scary. I find it liberating. I find it liberating to think about, well, let's just connect. You know, let's find connections as people and then go with those connections and see what happens. It doesn't mean that I think, oh, stop all the diversity initiatives, but it means stop thinking that that's enough. Stop thinking that once you have a certain number, you reach a certain number of Black people within your institution, then you don't have to think about race and you're done.
Sophia Samatar is a poet and writer who teaches at California State University. You'll find a link to her essay on our website at ttbook.org. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. If we think debates about privilege are complicated now, just wait until we can genetically engineer it. I mean, seriously, the day is coming when scientists will be able to offer prospective parents a whole raft of genetic improvements, basically to select for smarter, more beautiful babies. If that sounds like a terrible idea, let me introduce Oxford bioethicist Julian Savulescu. He thinks we actually have a moral obligation to use new technology to create the best possible children. Steve Paulson recently sat down with him to talk about hot-button issues like eugenics and human cloning.
Right now, there are serious research efforts to clone various animals, but cloning humans is off the table. I mean, that is considered just beyond the pale. Are you saying that's going to change?
Well, cloning of animals is routine in farming. Cloning in humans is used to produce stem cells, not embryos or fetuses or human beings, but stem cells for the treatment of disease. When it comes to cloning a human being, that also is completely possible now. You can split an early human embryo in two, into identical twins, deliberately. That's safe and reasonably efficient. You could freeze one of those identical twins and you could implant it some years after the first. So you could have identical twins 10 years separated in age. So that technology is already there. It's not done because there's not clearly a need. There's not clearly a point to it.
Why would there be a need to do that? I mean, what circumstances could you foresee?
Well, I mean, for example, imagine that changing reproduction, women having children later and later, often not being able to have children even with IVF. Let's say you've got one embryo left. Let's say that last embryo was implanted and she was involved in a car accident and was about to lose the pregnancy from bleeding, and you could take a cell from that embryo and clone another embryo if that pregnancy was lost. That would be something that would be attractive to people if, you know, reproductive cloning was possible. It would give them the chance to have their own child. So one of the lessons of ethics is you can't make general pronouncements. Cloning is always unethical. It must be banned under all circumstances.
So you don't see any fundamental ethical objection to human cloning. It all depends on
the circumstances. Well, I mean, in reality, nobody does. Well, mate, no, that's not true. A few people do. But you've got to remember that 1 in 300 pregnancies involve clones. Identical twins are clones. They are much more genetically related than a clone using the nuclear transfer technique where you take a skin cell from one individual and create a clone from the other.
But that's not something that we engineer. That just happened, right?
Well, again, one of the big mistakes in ethics is to think that means make all the difference. But the fact that we've done it or nature has done it is irrelevant to the individuals. So if it turned out that, say, you know, Jim and John, a couple of identical twins, say they'd arisen not through the natural splitting of an embryo, but because some embryologist, some IVF doctor, had divided the embryo at the third day after conception, what difference would it make? And the fact that they arose through choice and not chance is, in my view, morally irrelevant.
So this whole idea that, you know, we could, in a sense, play God, tamper with the laws of nature and create things that wouldn't exist otherwise, that's a red herring to you.
Well, we're playing God every day. I mean, you know, we play God when we vaccinate, we play God when we give, you know, women pain relief during labor. And of course, the challenge is to decide how to change the course of nature, not whether to change the course of nature.
Now, you have said that parents actually have an ethical responsibility to select the best children they can have using whatever technology might be available. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Well, there are many things that we can do which will affect the start that our children have in life in terms of the genes that they've inherited. Genetic technology enables the testing of embryos and the production of more than one embryo. And in my view, we should use those tests to look for genes which are correlated with greater advantages or opportunities in life. So one which is often discussed is being hearing or deaf, or having higher intelligence or greater aptitude at school or less. Now, my argument is that we ought to select children who have better opportunities of better lives. Now, most people accept that when it comes to diseases. Say, well, you know, that's fine to choose a healthy embryo rather than one with a catastrophic disease. But many people draw the line at disease. They say, well, once you get into the healthy range, then we shouldn't be playing God. We shouldn't be interfering in nature.
Right, because, I mean, this raises the specter of, you know, with tinkering with the genes, you could essentially buy or create smarter, stronger, more beautiful children.
Indeed, you could. And in my view, to the degree that those characteristics have an effect on how happy and how well a person's life goes, we should choose those genes. For example, 10% of kids today are on Ritalin for attention deficit disorder. And that's not because there's been some epidemic of attention deficit disorder. It's because if you have poor impulse control, if you can't concentrate long enough, if you can't defer small rewards now for large rewards in the future, you're crippled as a human being. You're crippled because you can't make plans for the long term, whatever you want to do, whether you want to be a plumber, a taxi driver, a lawyer, or the president. Now, if you were able to test for very poor impulse control in embryos and identify those that were going to start off life with that significant, what I believe is disability, I believe we should select ones that are going to have a better chance of having a wider range of choices in life and much higher chances of success, whatever they want to do.
Okay, but it's one thing to talk about controlling impulse control. It's another to talk about trying to enhance the smarts, the intelligence of a baby. I mean, basically cognitive enhancement through genetic engineering.
Well, it does raise another level of ethical concerns, but I think the question we always have to ask and reflect, you know, what should we do? Education is a cognitive enhancer. Computers and the internet are cognitive enhancers. We give children food supplements and better diets to enhance cognitive ability. So if we can do that through a genetic mechanism, why should we treat that differently to, say, a dietary supplement or some external technology like computing or the internet? The only difference between giving a vitamin and giving gene therapy is gene therapy is risky, really risky. And that's why we don't do it. But if it becomes safe, and if science gives us the opportunity of improving those people's lives, I think we should use it.
Hmm. What about the specter of eugenics, of creating superior groups of people? This doesn't worry you?
Many people are concerned about eugenics, and they remember the Nazi program of sterilization and then extermination of people deemed to be unfit. Their targets were people with intellectual disability, mental illness, and criminality. Now, it's important to recognize this wasn't a program that was unique to Nazi Germany. The extermination part was, but the sterilization, the prevention of reproduction was common through Europe and the United States. Many states in the United States had eugenics laws that enabled people who were intellectually disabled or mentally ill to be sterilized against their will. So this kind of eugenics was one of the darker sides of the 20th century. But eugenics itself literally just means well-born. It means having a child who is better in some way. Now, eugenics is alive and well today. When people screen their pregnancies for Down syndrome or intellectual disability, that's eugenics.
Because the reason to do that would be you would abort the fetus if you find that your fetus does have Down syndrome.
Exactly. If you were to give, you know, a therapy that cured Down syndrome or disposition to mental illness at either the embryonic, fetal or infant level, that would be a kind of eugenics. What was wrong with Nazi eugenics was it was involuntary. People had no choice, whereas people have a choice today. Secondly, it was racist and it was aimed at creating a certain kind of society. It was what's called social Darwinism. Today, eugenics is about giving couples a choice about having a child who will have a better or worse life for themselves. So it is a eugenics program, but it's sometimes called liberal eugenics. So the idea that making choices for the next generation is always Nazi eugenics is a deep mistake.
Now, we've talked a fair amount about some of the ethics involving reproduction and new reproductive technology. What about dying? Do we need to rethink the ethics of when it's okay for people to die?
Well, I think dying is, again, something that matters to people a lot. And there's two aspects that we'll have to confront. One, if we're already confronting, that is what control should we have about when and how we die? And I think ethically that's an uninteresting topic. You know, of course, people should be allowed to decide, you know, when and how they exit this world.
So you have no problems with euthanasia?
Well, I mean, I have problems with how it might be implemented, but in principle, if I want to end my life and someone else wants to help me, what business is it of the state or other people to interfere in that?
Okay, so you said that's the uninteresting question about death. What's the interesting one?
Oh, the interesting question is how long we should live. If we could attack aging, which is actually the real disease that causes, you know, adult onset cancer and cardiovascular disease, stroke and diabetes and these sorts of diseases, if we could turn off aging, people could live healthily maybe for 200 years, maybe longer. So I think that you will find over the next 20 or 30 years the possibility of radically extending human life. And then we'll face the deep question, how long should we live? How many people should there be? How should we change work? How will we pay for people living to 150? How will younger people carve out a place in society? So these, I think, are really deep and difficult questions. Will life become boring? Is this something that people should have a choice over, or should we place termination criteria on how long people should? So again, rather than us dying through just what happens to us naturally, it may be that our death starts to become not just our choice, which is the euthanasia debate, but society's choice.
Right. I mean, there are obvious questions about overpopulation. I mean, can the Earth handle, you know, all those people and questions of environmental degradation? And as you say, how do the younger people coming up fit into all of this if their elders never leave the scene?
I mean, is it better to have, you know, a society with 1 billion people or, you know, 500 million people, say the US, living to 80? Or is it better to have 250 million people living to 160? Those are difficult questions that we may well have the power to ask. It'll be us that'll have to decide. The exciting period now is we have to make decisions, and this idea that, you know, well, we'll just leave it to the market to resolve it, I think is not going to continue to wash.
Julian Savulescu is a moral philosopher at the University of Oxford. And by the way, Steve did a longer interview with him, which ran in Nautilus magazine recently. If you'd like to read it, you can find a link on our website at ttbook.org. If you like what you heard this hour, subscribe to our podcast. Just look us up on iTunes, Stitcher, or any other podcasting app. And if you really want to help us out, leave a review. That helps other people find the show. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Madison, Wisconsin, and the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. Raymond Tungekar produced this hour, with help from Charles Monroe Kane, Doug Gordon, and Craig Ely. Joe Hartke is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer, and I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.